We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. Just a moment here, we'll be talking with Bob McChesney about the state of American news media and about a new book that he's co-authored that explores the subject. The title of his book is The Death and Life of American Journalism. And, of course, we'll be happy to take your questions, your comments, your calls. Just before we do that, I do want to remind people that here now over the next couple of days, we're also encouraging people to support this station. And from time to time, we have to sit here in front of the microphones to remind you just how vital your support is. Now, there are some people who have been very loyal in their support over the years, and to them we say thanks. But to other folks, for whatever reason, if you haven't been a financial supporter of the station, this would be a great time to do it. And we're only going to take here a couple of days. So as far as Focus 580 is concerned, I will have this opportunity today and tomorrow, and that's it. And we'll leave you alone for a while. But it is very vital. We're about midway through our fundraising year, and we're raising the money that will pay for the programs next year. So we need to get those dollars into the bank. And this would be a great opportunity for you to show your support for WILL. And there's also something special we have going here as well. We have established a partnership for this drive, a partnership with the Common Ground Food Co-op. And they will be donating the cost of 3 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank for every pledge that WILL receives during this mini drive. So the amount, that is up to you. What we hope is that we can add your name to this role we call the Friends of WILL, and those are the people that value the station enough in the programming to actually support it with their dollars. So it's easy to do that. You can call 217-244-9455. Do it that way. Or feel free to go online. Go to our pledge site, which is willpledge.org, and make a contribution that way. Either way, we certainly appreciate it. It means a lot to us, and it makes it possible for us to continue to bring you the programs that you enjoy. Well, now at this point, I would like to introduce to you the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Bob McChesney. He is someone who is well known as a scholar and critic of media. He's a professor in the Department of Communication here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's also the host of a program we have here on WILL, a program called Media Matters. That's on Sunday. And he is the co-author of a newly published book that is titled The Death and Life of American Journalism, the subtitle The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. It's published by The Nation Books, and his co-author on this is John Nichols. He's The Nation's Washington correspondent, associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and has been a longtime collaborator along with Bob. And we're very pleased that he could spend some time with us this morning to talk about the book. Questions, comments, welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, Bob.
Hey, David. Great to be here.
Hey, thanks very much for spending some time with us. We certainly appreciate it. For people who have been paying attention, if they've listened to your show, if they've listened to the program that precedes it on the media, they know what we're talking about when we talk about the crisis in American journalism. But I suppose for the benefit of anybody who's saying, well, what exactly do you mean? Maybe that's the place to start.
Absolutely. I think the state of journalism today is one of collapse. It is in steep decline. It's not just sort of a gradual process that'll work itself out and we'll have a recovery. What we've had is a gradual decline for a few decades, and then in the last 2 years, the bottom's come out of the cup. We're losing roughly 1,000 newspaper jobs a month. And we emphasize newspapers because commercial television and commercial radio have been cutting back their journalism to such a large extent that the major newsrooms of the country now are almost largely in newspapers. So as we lose newspaper newsrooms, we're losing the last newsrooms that are covering America for the most part.
Mm. Well, something important point I think that you make is that the problems that you point to, this is not something that just started within the past couple of years, even though I think a lot of people say, well, really, the problem here, it's the internet. That's what it is. The internet came along. It provided another source of information. It took ad revenue away from newspapers. That's a big thing people have pointed to. Classified ads and newspapers have gone way down. That was an important source of revenue for newspapers. And so people have said, well, you know, all of this is about the internet. Your point is that this kind of problem here, erosion of readership, shrinking news operations, that just didn't start within the past couple of years. This goes back decades.
It goes back to at least the early, middle 1980s, arguably even the 1970s. And one of the reasons we wanted to write the book was to clarify the role of the internet. The internet has certainly accelerated the process for the reasons you mentioned, and it's made it permanent, but it didn't create the process. Long before Google existed, there were major studies and major laments by working journalists and scholars about the decline of resources going to journalism in the United States throughout the 1980s and 1990s. We lost Washington Bureau's foreign correspondents. Science journalism virtually disintegrated during those decades. All these things that the big companies that gobbled up our news media couldn't find money doing. It was during this period, too, that young people stopped reading newspapers. And it's worth noting, David, that prior to the early 1970s, young people read newspapers at the same proportion as older people in the United States. And still in many European countries, young people continue to read newspapers at those levels. So it's a relatively recent phenomenon, and it's not entirely technology related. We believe it fundamentally owes to the tension between the profit demands on large companies seeking to maximize profits and the public services journalism. That's always been an uneasy marriage, but it worked fairly well for much of the 20th century when professional journalism was at its heyday. But it came under increasing strain by the 1980s, and now the bottom's come out of the cup.
Yeah. Well, something else that I think is important for people to understand, you have also taken a look at a little bit of the history of journalism in the United States. And you make this point that if you go back to early America, it was a very different way of thinking about what it was all about. Certainly, the profit was not the big motive. Advertising didn't pay for the newspapers, certainly that the people who were instrumental in founding the country felt that a robust press was extremely important. How has the model of journalism, and particularly in how it's supported, changed over time?
Well, I'm glad you pointed that, because one of the strongest parts of the book, I think, is this discussion, looking at our history and also looking at how we should understand journalism. Let's start at the present. I think for the last 100 years or so, advertising has provided between 60 and 100% of the resources for news in the United States. And it's given us the illusion that the market would always support the quality, if not the quantity, if not the quality of journalism we wanted in the United States, that there was always going to be money there. And in fact, we can now see, as advertising is running away from journalism, that was purely an accident, that advertising had no intrinsic concern with journalism per se. It was an opportunistic relationship. And now that advertising has found better ways to accomplish its commercial ends, it's jumping ship. Just last year, for example, the New York Times, for the first time in its history, had more revenues from circulation than advertising. Mm-hmm. Advertising will remain with some news media, but it's going to be a much smaller amount than in the past, and it will become nowhere near providing the resources we need for journalism. So the logical question one asks then is, if advertising has been supporting journalism for the last 100 years and now is leaving, well, the country didn't begin 100 years ago. It began 225 years ago, 235 years ago, and we had the greatest press system in the world throughout the 19th century. How did it work then if there wasn't advertising? And what we discovered in our research, in what we write about in the book, is that the U.S. press system had enormous subsidies from the very beginning, deep into the 19th century. The subsidies actually continue through this day, but they're nowhere near as important as they were until the middle or late 19th century. And David, I think the key point we come away from this historical episode is this. The founders of the Republic, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, to their great credit, opposed government censorship of press content. And it's one of the great revolutionary notions of freedom of the press that we embrace in the book, that I think all Americans embrace. You shouldn't have government censorship of private media or government control over newsrooms or government prohibiting anyone from starting a news medium. But at the exact same time, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, and all the founders, and really deep into the 19th century, it was just taken for granted that every bit as important to having the First Amendment work and having a free press was you had to have a free press in the first place. Then you worried about censoring it. And if there weren't resources to have a free press, it was a hollow right. And that's why the founders instituted extraordinarily massive postal and printing subsidies to spawn what was by far the most vibrant and democratic and freewheeling press system in the world in the 19th century.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Bob McChesney. He's professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, host of the program Media Matters that you hear on our station on Sunday afternoons. He's the co-author, along with John Nichols, of a newly published book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, published by Nation Books. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk. At illinois.edu. We have a caller here, and the first one in Champaign, and we'll go to line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I got a couple of quick observations, and maybe your guests could comment on that. Recently, about a couple of years ago, I got back from a trip in New York, and at that point, New York City had something like 45, 48 different newspapers, and I'm guessing that they are niches, very small markets because of the breakdown in population. I just found that very curious, given the current state of affairs in newspaper print. Was wondering, I know we're talking primarily about newspapers, but recently the passing of Paul Harvey on the radio, he was such an icon last year. Given the current state of affairs of media in general, was wondering if you guess, I'm guessing that the personality like that and the revenue that he brought in, I'm guessing that probably will never surface again in that type of form. And then finally, I was wondering if your guest could comment, extrapolate out the state of journalism. The young person wanted to get into it. What did he think, what does he think 5-10 years from now journalism is going to look like? What's the landscape going to be? I'll go ahead and listen.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, those are great questions, David, that the caller had. As for 45 or 48 newspapers in New York City a few years ago, I've never heard that figure. If that was a number that exists, I suspect 40 to 45 of them had circulations that were extremely small, and they weren't commercially viable operations. And my guess would be there also a lot of them probably were foreign language papers for immigrant groups. But I that's an extraordinary number. In fact, there were 25 daily newspapers in New York that were large and had healthy circulations and were commercially viable less than a century ago, as most of our major cities had a large number of competing dailies. But those days are long, long gone. And the rise of advertising basically led to the rise of monopoly in local newspaper markets. Secondly, as for Paul Harvey, I think, ironically, Paul Harvey didn't really break stories. He read other people's journalism and then commented upon it. I think that's what we have that passes for journalism a great deal today, be it Fox or MSNBC or even CNN. To a large extent, the cable TV news that we associate with journalism or commercial radio coverage of public affairs is people pontificating and bloviating on other people's journalism. It's a very inexpensive way to run a station. It's commercially lucrative. Fox has made a fortune doing this, and MSNBC is doing well. In addition, our argument in the book is that, we need real journalism, too. People actually covering stories. And then it's great to have the pontificators, let them fire away. But that's no substitute for journalism. Then finally, the caller makes a very important point about the state of journalism with kids and young people. And we're losing an entire generation of young people that want to be journalists. It's absolutely tragic. I go around the country giving talks on this book and on discussions of journalism. And there's just a whole generation of young people that want to do journalism. There's absolutely no jobs for them whatsoever. And I think one of the solutions we recommend in our book in Chapter 4 is that we should extend the AmeriCorps program from teachers to journalists. And take, 10, 20, 30,000 kids, pay them a stipend, and get them out into communities, neglected areas that are not being covered at all now because of the collapse of journalism, and give them employment, let them work for a local community station or public station or website, but give them experience. Let's build a generation of producing journalism. It's really a dangerous thing for us to enter the first time, maybe in our history, a generation that will not have people who can get paid to produce journalism.
Let's take another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yes.
my questions are going to be about the new innovations since the iPad came out yesterday, and you have the Kindle and stuff like that. Is journalism going to be shifting gears to something like that instead of just the regular printed form? And like you said, not paid journalism. Is this going to end up where our world's going to be a bunch of people blogging?
Well, those are great questions. And yes, definitely the guts of what we consider journalism, what John and I write about in our book, is going to be online. It's going to be digital. It's going to come through an iPad or a Kindle or a traditional computer or a telephone even. And that's increasingly the case. That's not going to change. And when we talk about newspapers, we're really envisioning, or even public radio and television or community radio and television, we understand all these media, all these newsrooms are going to be simultaneously digital. And ultimately, we're in a transition period in which the station we're listening to right now, as well as the newspaper, is going to be primarily a digital enterprise. So that's a really perceptive question and point. Now, the second part of it's one of the key issues John and I took up in our book, which is the idea that, well, we don't really have to worry about the disintegration of newsrooms, the lack of paid employment for people to cover communities with beats, with copy editors and proofreaders and fact checkers and the like, because we can have volunteer labor on the internet replace them, and just, you know, people who have some free time to kill can sort of do their own thing online, and that will sort of replace what we're losing. And we go through that in great depth, because John and I are both bloggers, and we live in the blogosphere, and we just don't think there's a shred of evidence that that will be sufficient. We think that's going to greatly democratize and improve our journalism. But if we don't have newsrooms competing to cover stories with people who are accountable for beats, we're just going to have huge areas of our country, especially public and civic life and government, completely in the dark, and it's not going to be replaced. It's just completely implausible as far as we can tell looking at the evidence. And David, to give some of the examples that we mentioned in Chapter 1, of the sort of stuff that simply won't get covered because it takes resources, State House coverage in all 50 states has plummeted in the last decade. Really, it's been going on for a couple of decades. And there are literally states now where the State House and the state government aren't covered full-time anymore by working reporters. And, you know, that takes, you know, that's not glamorous work, but it's absolutely essential. Same thing with municipal governments. Not glamorous work, but it's essential. And we can't just hope and pray that there's some guy who's unemployed or is independently wealthy or has got some time to kill who's going to trot down there and do this out of the goodness of his heart. There's no country that's ever had a journalism system that worked like that, and ours won't either.
Yeah.
Well, right. That's my biggest concern, is that these areas aren't going to be covered. You're going to have some guy sitting in a room typing, blogging things up. He may be charismatic. People like to read what he says. And he may not have a lick of validity to what he says at all, because he's not down at the courthouse looking things up. He's not really having his facts checked. And he's just giving an opinion. And that's what real good journalism is doing the legwork like that.
You know, and I'd add one thing. I actually am very keen on the blogosphere, and I think there's some – we've discovered an enormous amount of talent up on the internet that didn't get a chance to break through in the old media. But what that great talent on the internet does, I'll give an example. Say someone like Glenn Greenwald, who I think is a real revelation, and I've had him on my show a couple times. Glenn depends on other journalists breaking stories that then he can push along. He can fact check. He can bring in all sorts of new insights. But Glenn can't do it on his own. And Glenn's just one of 1,000 people up there. The way to envision the relationship between citizen journalists and the blogosphere and traditional news gathering and journalists is sort of a jazz band. This is the metaphor we use in the book. For a jazz band to be great, what you need is a rhythm section with a piano, bass, and drums that puts out the melody and the rhythm and the beat. And then it's great also to have some horns that improvise. And, you know, the rhythm section of journalism are the newsrooms that produce sort of the stories that cover the stuff. And ultimately, the blogosphere and citizen journalists can be the improvisers. But the improvisers need to have a rhythm section to work off of, with a melody and a beat. If they're just making noise on their own, independent of everyone else, it's just noise.
Yeah, I like that metaphor. I like that very much. Bob McChesney is our guest. He's professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, host of the program Media Matters, that you hear on our station here on AM 580 Sunday afternoons, and also is the co-author, along with John Nichols, of a newly published book that explores this territory that we're discussing pausing here. The title of the book is The Death and Life of American Journalism, and it's published by Nation Books. And we'll talk some more in just a second. We just do want to take a moment here, again, to encourage people to support the station. Dave Teal is the program director for WYLL-TV, and here's sitting in the studio with me. Dave?
Good morning. It's always great to be here, and of course, good to be here at an important time for WYLL AM. This is, of course, our mini pledge drive. This is the first day of a 3-day drive, and we're hoping to hear from you right now, you the listener, at 217-244-9455. Now, you know that we get some of our money from the government, state and federal government, but what would we be like if we counted on the government for all of our money? Now, would you trust that it came with no strings attached? Well, I probably wouldn't. And, but the difference is here at WYLL and public radio stations nationwide is that we're listener-supported radio. We get some money from the government, some money from the University of Illinois, but a great deal of our money comes from our listeners. And there's something special about that. That means that it's radio by, for, and about you. So we hope you'll call right now. Join 59 callers so far who have made pledges just this morning. So at 217-244-9455, when you do so, there's an added community benefit this morning. We have made a deal with the Common Ground Food Co-op and a partnership with them. They've graciously agreed to contribute the cost of 3 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. When you call or make a pledge online at willpledge.org, they will go ahead and contribute that cost of 3 meals, help feed 3 hungry people when you make that call. And so you can support WYLL, you can help fight hunger in our community, and call 217-244-9455. The first 250 pledges that we receive will be matched by the Common Ground Food Co-op. And so far, 59 in, so you can make a difference right now.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Dave. Again, our guest this morning is Bob McChesney. His new book is The Death and Life of American Journalism. It's just out from Nation Books. It looks like you're on a pretty grueling tour, Bob. I don't think I've seen too many author tours that included that many appearances.
Well, we're doing a ton of tours. We've done it last week. We're on the West Coast. Next week, we're in New York and Boston. And a couple weeks later, we're in Washington, D.C. and Philly. And we've got odd trips to Chicago and Milwaukee and L.A. scheduled for after that. And, but I want to say that when Harriet Williamson from WILL called me and asked about this show, and she said, "You're willing to talk to me in a pledge drive, Bob?" I think she knew it was a rhetorical question, because it's my favorite thing to do is to talk on pledge drives on public and community stations. And I especially, as I think listeners know, love WILL. I think it is an exemplary public station. And I think when you travel as much as I do and you see the state of public radio in other communities, you really appreciate what a special community-based, regionally-based powerhouse WILL is, and what an asset it is to East Central Illinois and the whole state. And, it's something that we just, if you lose it, you can't replace. And so we have this crown jewel here at WILL, and I hope that listeners will give whatever they can to support this tremendous station. The money, I can promise you, does not go to hot tubs or junkets to Las Vegas. It goes to pay the elementary bills. This is an organization that is run on the labor of love of a handful of people like yourself, David. And it's just an honor to be associated with the station.
We appreciate the kind words. And, of course, you do a show here on the station on Sunday afternoons, which I know a lot of people appreciate. And one more thing I guess I want to mention is, as part of what you and John are doing, the two of you will be here, well, I guess, in about 3 weeks to do an event at the Siebel Center. And anybody can attend. The tickets are free, but you do need to have a ticket. So if people want to call us here at the radio station, 333-7300, area code 217, they can get a ticket. And so then the two of you will be talking about this book and this subject.
We're going to 3 weeks from Sunday. It's a live show at the Siebel Center. We're going to be talking about our book. We'll do a live show. And John and I will talk separately about the book and take Q&A afterwards. Books will be sold there. With every penny that's raised will go directly to WILL. Not 1% will pass go.
Very good. Well, we have several callers here to get in and some who've been pretty patient here. So we'll get right back to it. Someone in Effingham here, line number 2. Hello.
I concur with Mr. McChesney's assessment of WILL and yourself, David, in particular. Very rare. Mr. McChesney, I caught you on Bill Moyers, I think, 2 weeks ago, and that was very enlightening, too. My question is, the state of the college press. I'm not tuned in vitally with the Daily Illini, but I do volunteer at Eastern Illinois University and see the Daily Eastern News of the five publications when they are publishing. And they seem to be fluff. That the I've been told by the staff there, who for the last 2 years have denied my letters and pushed me to the side. One even accused me of plagiarism, which, you know, I it was offensive, but what could I do? And so I still contribute letters, 250 words, they say, and I do that occasionally, but I never see them appear. And the social matters that I, and the economics that I write about are pertinent, but the main thrust of the paper, they even told me there at the Eastern News, was to train their own columnists and their own writers and the blips and stuff that appear in that paper. And it just seems like a high school or perhaps a grade school news event. And I wonder, my question is, is that universal? Do I know there are tons of college papers all over this country, but you know, having access to that is out of my realm. But nevertheless, I'm wondering if that is a trend, if they've been downgraded to basic teenage nonsense, and all the other aspects that journalism should be about now are being neglected.
Well, I'm in no position, caller, and thank you for the call. I'm in no position to pass judgment on specific college newspapers, and I'd be hesitant even to look at one or two copies of a paper and generalize from it. But I will say I have traveled around, and that's not my general sense from looking at college newspapers. I've seen a lot of terrific ones around the country, but I can't talk about any other specifics. The important point you raise, though, that we talk about in the book, is that resources to student journalism, radio, TV, websites, especially at the high school level, has been slashed dramatically in the last couple generations. And all the research shows that when young people are about producing journalism, not just trying to read it, but actually make stories and do it, it greatly enhances their appreciation of freedom of the press, what the press does, and their civic involvement. So one of the things John and I call for in Chapter 4 is a dramatic increase in revenue so that every high school in this country can have a newspaper, a website, a radio station, and cover its school, and ideally get out and start covering in the neighborhood and the community, because there's not much being done out there. There's the sort of fertile territory now because no one else is tilling those fields. And, you know, I think we've got to make a real commitment to make journalism part of the young person experience in this country. You know, we can't emphasize again that we're losing an entire generation. And that's something we've never done before, and it's a place I don't think we want to go.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We have a couple of others, and we'll continue and go next to Bloomington, Illinois, and that's our line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, I want to thank David Hinge and everybody everybody associated with the radio station there. I know he's got to put up with my long rant, you know, tangents that I have, and I want to thank them again. And it's very knowledgeable stuff you have in the station. And I have donated in the past, and I'll keep donating. And I think you guys have a great show going on there. So keep up the good stuff there. I wanted to make a comment about the current crisis with this, the papers, the lack of journalism. I don't think there's a lack of journalism. I think what's happening is they're just going from the paper onto the computers. And to me, I think it's much easier for me doing research to get on the internet and you know, read things, because I've got family scattered out all over the United States, than it is for me to buy a paper. It's a buck here, a buck there. By the time I buy five papers, I'm spending quite a bit of money. So, you know, and that's the other thing with the research I do. I end up buying USA Today, Daily Herald, I'll do New York Times, some of the local papers either here or across the other parts of the country. and it gets expensive. So when I get online, if some of them are free and some of them aren't, and for me, if I want to do research on stuff, it's easier for me just to do that. I don't know. I'll kind of shut up now and kind of hang up and listen to what you got to say. And again, keep up the good work, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's a really terrific question. And the problem with your approach is that those people doing journalism, distributing it for free online, are laying off reporters right and left and producing a lot less. And eventually it's going to dry up because they're not going to do it as a charity, private businesses. And that's the great crisis we write about in the book. There was a recent study out of Baltimore done by the Pew Research team. It's a very highly regarded team. And I don't know if, David, if you've heard about this yet, but it was just done, recently released, sort of the media ecology of Baltimore, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And the question they asked in Baltimore was, you know, how much has new media, all the websites, and there's lots of them in Baltimore. You've got Johns Hopkins there. You've got a very sort of upscale community in the Baltimore metropolitan area. How much of the journalism there that the new media, the internet, the blogosphere, how much are they producing to replace the old media news hole? And they found out that 96% of the news stories of Baltimore that require reporting, original news stories that are broken, 96% still come from old media. Only 4% come from not old media. And of those, half came from the police Twitter. So it was just the police department twittering out news, and that became went into the news cycle. And what's important here, too, in the Pew study that was very depressing but very revealing, got to the point that the caller just had, is that they found out that the Baltimore Sun, the newspaper, is producing the vast majority of original news in Baltimore. Well, it's producing 30% less than it did 10 years ago and 73% than it did in 1991. I mean, so news and media aren't creating news stories. The old media, the amount they're covering is shrinking rapidly, and it's heading due south. And then to top off the depressing picture that Pew gave us, they looked at the sources of those stories that media were producing in Baltimore last year, and 86% of the stories, the fresh original stories that other people used and that were based on giving people a sense of what's going on in Baltimore, 86% came from public relations. Only 14% came from journalists going out and doing the stories. And 30, 40 years ago, the standard figure was that 50% of news stories came from public relations, 40 to 50%. Now we're up to 86%. And I think this gets at a point we talk about in the book that listeners really need to consider. We're not going towards a post-journalism future where there's not going to be news. There will still be 24/7 cable channels and websites and bloggers and all that. But what we're going toward is really where there won't be journalism, where it's going to be pretty much a propaganda state. We did research, you might have seen it in the book, we're very proud of it, where we went through government employment data to look at the number of PR officials to working journalists since 1960 in the United States.
Right.
And in 1960, it was basically a one-to-one relationship, one PR person per journalist. By the early 1980s, it had changed slightly. It was 1.2 PR people to journalists. Today, the ratio is 4-to-1, four PR people for every working journalist. And at the rate it's changed in the last 3 years, it could well be 6 or 7-to-1 within 5 years.
One thing I want to ask you about real quick, and then we got some other callers, because it's something that was big in the media world in terms of news, at least just recently, and it goes to this question of what's available on the web and does it cost you anything. The New York Times announced that sometime within the next year, they were going to start charging people for access to the website. And I think that a lot of people are looking to that and saying, well, if the New York Times can do that and make that work, then many more large news organizations will be paying for access to the web. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, they've tried it before and it didn't work. We write about this at length in the book. We're skeptical that it can actually succeed, that they can actually create a system where people will pay sufficiently so they can have credible newsrooms online. The evidence doesn't support it now. I think it's almost a Hail Mary pass for traditional media as much as anything, as much as a coherent plan. But we think ethically and morally and politically, it's really not the direction we ought to be going. It's trying to take 19th and 20th century market models and impose them on a 21st century technology where we're setting up electronic barbed wire all over the internet, and where people to go from one website to other have to stop and pay, they have to be harassed by copyright police. To us, the real solution eventually is to have the payment up front, to get the money into producers' hands at the beginning of the process, and then make it free and accessible to everyone online, to embrace the genius of the internet rather than try to battle it in what we think would be a hopeless battle. And then finally, even if the commercial interests were able to succeed, even if the New York Times could set up what they call a paywall, and so to get any of the content that's produced by journalists, you have to pay for it online in one way or another, there's no reason to think there would still be anywhere near the resources to generate the quality and quantity of journalism we're accustomed to or that we require to have self-government work. We still have a huge crisis.
Yeah, one other thing that just really struck me, I was reading about this the other day, the Newsday, the Long Island-based paper that also circulates in New York, they apparently, maybe 3 months ago, they set up a paywall for their website after having spent a lot of money on overhauling the website. And in those months, they have gotten a grand total of 39 subscribers. So they spent something like $4 million overhauling the website, and they've gotten now about $9,000.
Well, research shows, David, that most newspapers that have done what Newsday has done, and there have been a bunch of them, do it primarily to scare people who go on to get it for free to force them to buy a subscription, and that's really the function of it.
Yeah. All right, let's talk with some other callers and go to Champagne Line 1. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I heard Senator Lieberman from Connecticut being interviewed. And the interviewer said something like, we know that you get a lot of contributions from the insurance companies. And Senator Lieberman said ingenuously, I don't think they've ever asked me, ever told me how to vote. And this was not followed up by the journalist, and I thought, well, maybe the journalist just did not have the facts as to how much money does come into the campaigns of Senator Lieberman. And then I realized that I don't know either. It's like everybody knows Congress is bought and sold, but where can we get the facts as to how much money? Take the medical overhaul bill, and where can we find out how much money exactly or precisely has come in from these medical institutions like the pharmaceuticals, et cetera, so that we can see how these people are being bought?
Boy, what a wonderful question, and it's difficult to do justice because it's a very complex answer to give a great answer to that or a good answer, but let me simply say that what you're saying citizens need is exactly what journalism needs to do. I mean, it's not possible for 300 million Americans to become research experts on campaign finance and making these links. That's why we need good journalism, competing journalists and competing newsrooms, ideally. And I think one of the things that happens is we hollow out newsrooms and we go to the sort of the pontificating model. It puts much more pressure on journalists to do like what's happening in Baltimore, which is to basically put a mic in front of a politician's mouth, let them talk. And, you know, if you do have an antagonistic question, it's simply the talking point that comes from the opposite party. It's not like a journalist has actually done hard research. And I think because of that, it's one of the reasons why young people are turned off to journalism, because it seems like just a partisan mud bath where you don't really learn anything. And I'm reminded of that occasionally when you see what a really great journalist does, when they do their homework and you see, wow, this can really change things. It doesn't happen that much anymore in America, and it's pretty frightening that it doesn't. But the caller is absolutely right. A really good journalist studies the facts, knows their material, and when they get an answer from a politician, whoever the politician is, they push them to get something that squares with the facts. They don't just let them give a talking point and move on.
But that's, I guess, the point, again, to make is that the answer, the question that the listener poses, it's an answerable question. Mm-hmm. It just involves someone taking the time to do the research to find the answer.
That's right.
And if we don't have reporters and we don't have enough of them and they don't have the time to do the work, then that work isn't going to get done.
And our standards slip. So just putting a mic in front of a politician's mic, asking a question and moving on to the next question is considered now acceptable journalism.
Well, I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Bob McChesney. He's professor in the Department of Communication here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and is the co-author of a recent book. The title is The Death and Life of American Journalism. It's published by Nation Books, and he co-authored it with John Nichols. He's the Nation's Washington correspondent, associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. And as we mentioned, the two of them will be here in Champaign-Urbana to do an event on Sunday, February 21st. at the Siebel Center. It's a live version of Media Matters. They'll be talking about the book. And if you would like to attend, it's free, but you do need to have a ticket. So you can call us at 217-333-7300 here at the radio station, and you can get one. Other questions are welcome, too. And we have some other folks standing by. And next we'll talk with someone in Belgium, and that's line number two. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. My question here is that why is it that when journalism gets started here, we all get on the same wavelength, or I should say you all get on the same wavelength, and you'll report about the same thing until it just you get nauseated with it. And then the next big thing you move to. And we always forget about the other thing, and many times we totally forget about very important topics that might not really involve us personally, but involves others much more. We lose track of what's really important. That's the question I have about journalism.
Well, that is a fantastic question. And again, it deserves a longer answer than I can give on this show. But I think that it does relate to our topic in this important way. When resources are diminished in journalism and it becomes a lot of pontificating and shorthand work, the pack mentality that already existed in professional journalism is increased. And the ability for a reporter to get out or an editor to assign a story that's outside of what everyone else is doing that would take resources to develop and be defended, that ability is lessened considerably. And it just reinforces sort of the negative problems we've always had with professional journalism. By the way, this wasn't a problem the first 100 years of American history when we had a much more raucous and diverse press with these subsidies. And they were raising issues that no one in power wanted to talk about. In fact, one of the things we write up in the book that was stunning when we studied it was that the whole abolitionist press was leading the fight for press subsidies for the smallest, weakest papers, their papers. They couldn't exist without the postal subsidy. And they finally won free postage for weekly papers within their own counties by the end of the 1840s. And the abolitionist press's whole existence was trying to put an issue onto the political agenda in the United States that no one in power wanted to talk about in Congress for decades.
Thank you very much.
All right, to line number three. This is somebody on a cell phone. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you very much for both your programs. I was a little bit spotty earlier. I didn't hear everything you said, but I want to comment on your Baltimore theme. I know Ed Burns of The Wire has either was involved with the study or something about the inverse relationship of city press rooms and the coverage that they have on the politics of a local municipality and the corruption that goes on and their inverse, the less local newspaper coverage that you get, you have a lot more corruption. I just wanted you to maybe comment on that if you haven't already.
Well, I haven't directly because I thought it was self-evident, but it's worth repeating that if you have no journalists covering a state government or a city government, or the State Department, and the number of journalists covering all branches of government has absolutely plummeted, and we're left basically with people standing with mics just regurgitating what presidents and Joe Lieberman say and not even challenging them often. It's not. You simply means that huge amounts of public life are in the dark, and that's when corruption grows and festers. And, you know, it's funny. We often talk about the importance of journalism for democracy and the basis of this program and my work, my career. But, you know, journalism also is foundational for capitalism or for a market economy, any type of economy, but our economy no less, because if you don't have actual coverage that keeps people informed, your economy can easily gravitate to a plutocracy and corruption. And I think that we talk in the book about the coverage of the housing bubble and the financial bubble of the last 5 years. And it's clear that sort of a gutted out journalism was crucial to sort of letting these bubbles and letting this deregulation mania go far beyond what could be justified for even a routine scrutiny. And between 2005 and 2007, over one half of the citations in all news stories on the housing bubble came from the chief economist of the housing industry, who was telling people prices would never go down, buy, buy, buy. And this was presented uncritically as sort of expert opinion. Mm.
Something I want to make sure that we do here, because we've talked a lot about the problem, is to at least give some thoughts about solutions. And I know that you and John, you're not saying that you have the ultimate solution, but what you want to do is at least get people talking, get this conversation going. You've put out some ideas. You're interested in what other people's ideas are. What are some of your thoughts about dealing with the issues that we have been talking about?
Well, if you start from the premise it's a public good and that advertising is sharply declining and there simply aren't the resources to give us in the marketplace to give us the journalism we need in quality or quantity, then you have to have government subsidy. We go through all the other philanthropist donations and you add them all up and pump them up as much as you can and you're still on the 10-yard line, the wrong 10-yard line. And so you need a lot of public money. And, you know, the United States in the first half of the 19th century, if you convert the amount of federal subsidy of journalism in the first half of the 19th century to today's GDP, today we'd be spending $30 billion to subsidize journalism at the federal level to match what they did in the 1840s. Likewise, if you look at European democracies, the most democratic nations in the world, according to The Economist magazine, Sweden, Germany, Denmark, Finland, Norway, Switzerland, these countries spend between $25 and $35 billion a year subsidizing journalism, if you include public media in that tally, but if they did it at U.S. level population on our per capita standard. So these other countries that are very democratic and have very free private presses, and in our own history, we've had massive subsidies. The key question is, what sort of subsidies can we do that will also protect the other core right, which is no government interference with the editorial prerogative or no government prohibition on someone starting a media? The founders thought those were reconciliable. And they did it for 100 years. We think they are, too, and that our democratic nations show the way. The starting point is dramatically increased money to public and community radio and television with the express commitment to hire more journalists to cover their communities, where we're just absolutely in the dark now in every town, most every town in this country, the number of journalists has plummeted. Increasing student media, doing that AmeriCorps for kids like we talked about. I also think we've got to have money that goes to the Small Business Administration to quarterback the process where all the towns where daily newspapers are dying, and we've already lost a couple hundred, and we're going to lose a lot more in the next few years, quarterback those papers to a post-corporate future, get them out of the hands of these chains that have run them into the ground, get them into the hands of local owners, maybe create low-profit models, which is a business concept which allows someone to be independent profit-making concern, but gives it sort of a community base and makes it eligible for donations. Or set up even nonprofit ownership if that will help. Whatever works so there are credible newsrooms, and ideally more than one, producing what the equivalent of a daily newspaper, even if it's digital. Because I think that as great as the internet is, David, with all those niche websites that cover, you know, I can go on there and find all sorts of websites that are directed towards someone my age with my interest. We also need to have some newsrooms in a community like WILL, which sees its mission as sort of sifting through the news and providing a view of what's important to everyone in the community, what we all share. And newspapers, even if they go digital, are crucial institutions. We can't lose those sorts of voices.
One more caller, I think line number two. I believe they're in Champaign. Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
I think one of the problems right now is a funding mechanism to support subsidies. So I'll give you an idea. How about let's tax all political advertising that's not coming directly from a politician's own campaign fund, and we'll tax those. We'll tax all that advertising at a fairly high rate, let's say 30%, and that money then would go to a direct postal subsidy for all paper and print media.
Well, you know, I love you. And I love you not because I necessarily agree with your plan, but this is the discussion we should be having. Once we, and I think in our book, in the first three chapters, we present fairly incontrovertible evidence that we've got to start having a discussion of where we get the money from and how we set it up in such a way as to promote the values that are crucial. And that's the next stage for this discussion. And I hope if our book accomplishes just to get us to that point, it'll be a massive success.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time for this part of Focus 580. But I want to again say that if you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book, and I mentioned a couple times, a book that Bob has co-authored along with John Nichols. The title of the book is The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. It is published by The Nation Books, and it's just out. The two of them have been spending time traveling around the country talking about it, and in fact, on Sunday, February 21st, at 12:30 in the afternoon. They'll be doing an event together. And this is, I guess what this is a live with a studio audience, as we say, version of Media Matters.
It will be. And then we'll also do more another hour afterwards, and we'll be talking about the book and giving a little talk. So I mean, it'll be a couple hours of fun.
All right. And that will be Sunday, February 21st. And, of course, every Sunday at 1 in the afternoon here on WILL AM, you can hear the program Media Matters with host Bob McChesney. He's a professor in the Department of Communication at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. Hey, thanks very much.
My great pleasure, David.
Programs here on WILL are made possible with support from Symphonia de Camera, presenting Spring Enchantment on Saturday, February 6th at 7:30 p.m. in the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The symphony celebrates spring with works by Mozart, Handel, and Schumann. More information available at 333-6280. And we certainly need to acknowledge some other important supporters of WILL programming, and that's the folks who listen to the station. A lot of them realize that their support helps pay the bills and keeps the programming here on the air. And so they send us money. And what we do periodically is we sit here in front of the microphones and remind people that that's real important. And in fact, you know, this is, we have very generous folks who have supported us year after year. But the fact is, this is one of the best ways that we have of talking to people who have not done that. So if you're a listener, but you're not a supporter, well, this is a good time to change that. Dave Teal is here with me in the studio. He's the program director for WILL TV.
And yes, I mean, it is, of course, very important to hear from you. And if you've been listening for the last hour, of course, you've been hearing all about how journalism is dying and there's not enough money for it. Well, if you're feeling like you can't do anything about it, you can do something about it right here, right now. Call 217-244-9455. The dollars that you contribute to WILL AM, of course, help to pay for our own news department and the other activities that we do here. And when you call during this pledge drive, this three-day pledge drive that started today, the first 250 pledges that we get will be matched by the Common Ground Food Co-op. They will donate the cost of three meals for each pledge that we receive to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So the cost of three meals donated to Eastern Illinois Food Bank for each pledge at 217-244-9455. Or, of course, if you're online, you can pledge at willpledge.org. We'd love to hear from you right now.
Yeah, it would be great if we could do that. We're making nice progress here, but we do want to remind people that this is short. We're
right.
Only going to be here for the rest of the day and tomorrow and a little bit of Saturday.
Right.
And then we want to get back to doing full-time the programming that people appreciate. You know, we don't want to take a lot of time to do this, but it is very important for us that we do take some time to do that, and we hope that people will respond.
Yeah, and we've heard from 59 so far, so toward 250, so call now.
All right.